waiting, from the disappointment that Zanpa didn't return in time, from the trek to my land, and from expelling my daughter. I lie on my side, with Spiny Thistle cradled to my breast. The moon illuminates the trees, filtering leafy shadows across the grove. If only there were a way to make her remember this moment. Ama has already made a fire and heated water by the time I wake. I feel far worse physically this morning. Sore, tired, empty. Mentally, it's as though I've been inhabited by a spirit. Lost, confused, but determined to carry out my misdeeds. Ama holds Spiny Thistle while I eat. "Look around you," she coos to the baby. "This is the mother tree. These are the sister trees. You may never see this place again, but it is yours by right. Our blood is in this earth. It has nourished these trees. You are a part of them, and they are a part of you." She pauses before continuing. "There can be no proper naming ceremony for you, since neither your father nor one of your grandfathers can perform the rite. You will live outside our Akka traditions, but you will take two gifts with you when you leave our mountain today." Ama glances at me, commanding my attention. I put down my cup to listen. "First, I name you Yen Ye. You are the first daughter of my only daughter, Li Yan to Yen Ye." With no father to properly name her, my daughter will never learn to recite the lineage. The sharpness of regret stabs into my chest, cleanly, cruelly, irrevocably. "Second," Ama goes on, "I'm giving you the most precious gift we women have in our line." With one hand, she reaches into the picking basket she brought with her and pulls out a round cake of tea. Wrapped in rice paper, the cake is not so big, maybe 18 centimeters across and 2 centimeters thick. Age has faded the ink drawings. All my life, I've lived in the same house with my ama, but I've never before seen the tea cake. And, not that it's all that important, I thought we Akka didn't make tea cakes, let alone wrap them in decorated papers. That's why Tea Master Wu had to show everyone in the village what to do. In answer to my unspoken thoughts, Ama says, "Since I came to your Aba in marriage, I've kept this hidden in the most powerful and safe place in our home. The space between the family altar and the women's room, and the friends living with child that came from me and your sisters-in-law, buried in the soil directly below. Girl, you think you learned so much about tea when the stranger was here with his son. He says he came here to save Pu'er from extinction." Even in this most profound moment, she snorts her distaste for Mr. Huang. "He knows nothing. He learned nothing. He was looking for aged tea? This is aged tea. It has survived many changes and threats. Your great-grandmother secreted it away from the Japanese in the 30s. Your grandmother hid it from the revolutionaries in her 40s. It was my responsibility to protect it during the dark years of the Great Leap Forward in the 50s, when tea tree plantations were razed and replanted with tea terraces. We were forced to change our old ways and make vast quantities of inferior tea to sell to the masses. We worked so hard, and we were so hungry. Many people starved to death." Ama is usually so careful with her words, releasing only those that are necessary. Not this time. And her urgency is marked by my need to absorb this new information about her and this strange tea cake. "Then came the 60s and 70s, she continues, "when the Red Guards sought the destruction of the four olds of ideas, culture, customs, and habits. We were no longer allowed to drink tea, because it was seen as recalling hours of leisure, as though we'd ever had those. We were forced to tear down the spirit gate and the village swing. To keep the old ways would have been to commit a political crime, but for anyone to think someone like me would forget? Or let something as precious as tea become extinct, as that stranger fool said? All this time, she could have said something to Mr. Huang. She could have helped him more. "This cake," she says, turning her attention to Yanye, "goes back many generations of women in our family. It is the best gift I can give you, my granddaughter. Yet it holds many secrets and much suffering. Carry it with you wherever you go as a reminder of who you are and where you came from." Ama places my baby on the tea cake so that it serves as a shield on which to rest her neck and fans above her head like a halo, and then binds them together with a hand-woven blanket. She picks up Yanye and gives her to me. "You must go." I shake my head. "I'm terrified." "Keep walking down the mountain." Ama gazes out across the peaks, blue and hazy in the distance. Her jaw tightens as she pulls her knife from her belt and tucks it in mine. "Protect yourself," she says, and I clutch Yanye closer to my body. "When you see people, ask the way to Menghai. Mark your route for your return." Getting around the boulder is hard with the baby, but Ama is at my side, steadying me, keeping me from falling. As soon as we reach the old and faint path, she places on my back the basket packed with the necessities for my journey. "Support her neck," she instructs. "Keep walking. I told the others we would be gone for 4 nights. That gives you 3 more nights to get her to a safe place and then come home. I will wait here for you." Then she turns her back on me, grabs onto the boulder, and shimmies out of sight. I feel like a girl in an Akka fable. The tiny trail that leads away from my grove joins the larger path. I bypass my village entirely, always heading down. Where the path branches, I build a pile of rocks or cut into the bark of a tree. I stop every once in a while to clear my throat 3 times and rub the hair on my arms and legs. The world knows that spirits are not that clever or brave. They are frightened of saliva, and the sounds of human hairs are excruciating to their ears. When Yanye whimpers, I hunker down and bring her to my breast. I lay her on pine needles when I need to relieve myself and change my bloody rags. I eat rice balls as I walk. Night falls. I wend my way deep into the forest to find what I hope will be a place safe from the worst outside spirits. I strike 3 trees with my fist. "You be my home. Watch over us." I roll out my sleeping mat and curl around my daughter. As soon as dawn brightens the sky, I'm up again. I hurt all over, and my body screams for more rest, but I have to keep moving if I'm going to give Yanye a chance at life. The mountains are still steep and should be unusable, but tea terraces undulate, following the curves of the hillsides and climbing until they disappear into the morning mists. The farmers have triumphed over nature, as I must now conquer my physical pain and weakness. When the sun is high, the mountain path widens and I start to hear rumbling sounds. I reach a dirt road with a truck going one way, a tractor going the opposite way, and a few people bearing wares trudging in both directions. I need to find this spot when I come home. I can't leave a pile of rocks by the side of the road, because what if someone or something tips it over? I struggle to find a landmark, but I see nothing different from what I've been passing through all morning. I take one of the rags Ama gave me and tie it to a branch. Please let it be enough for me to find on my return. I step into the road, not knowing which way to go, left or right. I ask a woman wearing Dai nationality clothes and carrying a basket heaped with corn cobs the way to Meng Hai.
We're going there too, she answers. You can follow us if you like.
I feel better to be walking with someone from a hill tribe, a stranger but still familiar, because every step reveals something completely new. The land turns to gentle slopes, and what's planted on them changes. The impossibly towering tea terraces are far behind me now. Instead, trees I don't recognize rise up in neatly planted rows. Now, when I stop to mark my route with a slash from Amma's knife, thick white goo oozes from the trunks like white blood. The Dai woman tells me they're rubber trees.
Are they for eating? I ask.
She laughs and shakes her head. I begin to see houses, which are unlike any in the mountains, made of stones, clay bricks, and some type of smooth gray material. Then I see my first two-story building. And then the most astounding sight. Way above my head, my first airplane. Yinye stirs and squawks in her bird-like way. I say goodbye to the Dai woman and step off the road to find a spot of shade. I unwrap my baby and set the tea cake on the ground. I bring her to my breast. My milk hasn't come in yet, but she sucks and sucks and sucks. My baby is strong, and she'll need courage to survive what's coming, while my insides ring and constrict. I have to bite my lips from the double pain, and yet the way she looks up at me. Her eyes are so clear. When she falls asleep, I wrap her back up, making sure to support her neck as Amma showed me. Then, it's back to the road. 2 hours later, as darkness falls, we arrive at the city. Dust churns and swirls as cars, trucks, motorcycles, tractors, donkey and horse-pulled carts, bicycles, and so many people bump along the dirt road. Even in my despair, the sight is amazing. But the first time I hear a horn, I almost faint, I'm so scared. Nearly everyone is dressed like Teacher Zong, in a Mao suit and cap, but some men wear gray pants, white shirts, matching gray jackets, and knit vests. That, too, looks like a uniform. Here and there, I spot someone like me, a member of a hill tribe, immediately identifiable by our embroidered indigo clothes and the special headdresses that mark us as Bulang, Dai, or Aka. I recognize things I've learned about in school. Apartment buildings, petrol stations, dress shops, restaurants. Restaurants! Imagine going to a store like that, sitting down, telling the man what you want, and then he brings it to you? But it's the electric lights that are most alarming and fascinating. White lights, yellow lights, orange and red lights, green lights, glowing from buildings, illuminating roadways, shining like evil eyes from cars. I stay on the main thoroughfare, afraid that if I turn off it, I'll never find my way home. I don't know how to locate the orphanage. I'm surrounded by strangers in a place that could never even come to me in a nightmare. I'm hungry. My private parts hurt. I'm weak from giving birth and all the walking. And I absolutely must not be caught, because even for Han-majority people, what I'm about to do is against the law. I've heard of jail, prison, and labor camps. Who hasn't? But no Aka has ever survived being sent to one. Not that I've heard of, anyway. An image of Amma gazing out over the mountains before she handed me the knife comes to me. The way she set her jaw. Anguish. Courage. Sacrifice. This is mother love. This is what I must find in myself now. I come to a tiny roadway that divides a block. It's also unpaved,
but empty of people and bicycles. I creep into the shadows and sit shielded by a discarded cardboard box with my back against the wall. From here, I can watch the street without being seen. Surely those people will need to sleep. I eat some rice balls, ration my water, and nurse Yenye again. I tell her everything I can about Aka Law, about her Ama and her Aba, about the lineage, and what it will mean to become a woman one day. How I will always love her. How I will think of her every breathing minute of my life. I whisper endearments into her face, and she looks up at me in that penetrating way of hers. Her tiny hand grips my forefinger, searing my heart and scarring it forever. I'm awakened later, who knows how much time has passed, by her mewling. I feel dawn coming in the quiet place around me, but for now the night is still murky and dim. I must act now. Already tears pour from my eyes. I make sure her blanket is tight around her and the tea cake secure. I put her in the box. She doesn't cry. At the corner, I peer in both directions. To the left, in the distance, two women approach, sweeping the powdery dust from the surface of the dirt road with brooms made of long thatch, slowly from side to side. Swish, swish, swish. I step out, turn right, and scuttle forward. I pass over two more streets, both deserted. All the while I'm whispering, "Your Ama loves you. I'll never forget you." I place the cardboard box on the steps of a building. No more words now. I must run. And I do. To the next corner, right, then right again, and to the next corner, so that I've returned to the edge of the main street. The two sweepers come closer. Swish, swish, swish. I dart across the road and hide on that side so that I can see the abandoned cardboard box. Its sides tremble. My daughter must be moving, realizing I'm gone. And then it comes, a terrible wail that cuts through the darkness. The two sweepers look up from their work, cocking their ears like animals in the forest. And then another croaking shriek. The women drop their brooms and come running. They don't notice me, but I see them clearly. Two elders, with faces like rotten loquats. They drop to their knees on either side of the box. I hear them clucking, concerned yet comforting. One picks up the baby, the other scans the street. I can't hear their conversation, but they're decisive and knowing as though they've encountered this situation before. Without hesitation, they begin marching back the way they came, back toward me. I slither farther into the shadows. When they pass me, I watch them until they reach their discarded brooms and continue on. I leave the safety of my hiding place and follow, creeping from doorway to doorway. They arrive at a building I passed earlier, right on the same main road. The woman holding Yenye sways and pats her back. The other woman bangs on the door. Lights come on. The door cracks open, a few words are exchanged, my baby is handed over, the door closed, and the two old women walk back to their brooms. The sign on the door reads, "Menghai Social Welfare Institute." I stay until the sun comes up. Grocers set baskets brimming with vegetables on the sidewalk. Barbers open their doors. Children walk hand in hand to school. The door to the Menghai Social Welfare Institute remains closed. I can't stop crying, but there's nothing more I can do. I begin my long walk back up Nanuo Mountain. I get lost only a few times. When I feel I can't take another step, I venture into the forest. I fall asleep holding Ama's knife. The next day,
By the time I reach my grove with the mother tree, where Amma is waiting for me, I'm empty of tears. From now on, I cannot, I must not, let anyone see my sorrow. The loneliness of that? Like I'm drowning.
Social Welfare Institute, Number 6, Middle Nanhai Road. Xishuangbana Dai Autonomous Prefecture, Yunnan Province, China. Report on Baby Girl Number 78. Today, a baby girl foundling was delivered into our care by street cleaners Lin and Hu. They report they did not see a mother, father, or any other person of interest. They are fully aware of the penalties for lying and have been honest in similar past situations. Baby girl number 78 arrived with part of her umbilical cord still attached. It looks 4 to 6 days dried. From this, I am giving her a birth date of November 24, 1995. Baby girl number 78 weighs 2.77 kilograms and is 47 centimeters in length. She has black hair. She does not have a birthmark or other identifying marks. As required, we have cataloged and stored her possessions, except for a cardboard box, which I sent to the kitchen to be used for vegetable storage. One cake of tea, one blanket, one shirt, one pair leggings, and one cap with charms. These items will remain with the child. The charms on the hat and the indigo coloring of the hand-woven blanket and clothing suggest that the child was born of an ethnic minority woman. Two photographs and a footprint of baby girl number 78 were taken during intake and will be added to her file. Signed, Director Zhou Shuling.
Shredded out of existence. The next 3 months are terrible. In the beginning, my breasts turn as hard as rocks with the arrival of my milk, and my insides continue to leak red tears. Even after the physical discomforts pass, I ache for my lost baby. Waves of grief wash through me, sometimes with such cruel force that my eyes pool beyond my control. When Amma sees me thus, she pinches the exposed back of my neck or snaps at me to do my chores more carefully, all to help me gather myself in front of the rest of the family. Abba, noticing I'm more subdued, decides I'm ready for marriage.
"It's time for you to start contributing to the increase of people," he declares.
In the fourth month, Mr. Huang and his son return. Mr. Huang looks the same. The boy looks completely different, with a head full of hair instead of a shaved dome. Abba shows off his new hand-operated rolling machine, for which he traded his best crossbow. "Now we can process an entire kilo in a half hour," he boasts. Mr. Huang shakes his head.
"Nothing mechanical can touch our leaves."
Abba, his shoulders slumped, puts his machine under the house with the pigs and the chickens. The stranger hires me again, and his son follows Amma everywhere she goes. Xian Reng has retained the Aka words he learned last spring, and now picks up even more. Tea Master Wu arrives from Yi Wu to supervise the killing of the green, kneading, drying, and sorting. He watches every step of the artificial fermentation process, too. We happily take Mr. Huang's money, and he gets to act like a big man. Beneficent. After 3 months, we know that the fermentation results are far better than those of last year. Once the cakes are made, Mr. Huang arranges for them to be transported off Nanuo Mountain and out of the country for storage and aging in Hong Kong.
"But I'm still missing my favorite leaves," Mr. Huang needles me at the end of his trip. "How much will you make me pay for them this year, hm? Double? Triple?
This time will you take me to your grove? I'd like to see how you care for your trees." I'm about to go pick leaves
when Ama stops me. She seems to have a magical sense when it comes to our trees. The grove is special to our family. It is special to you. Never let an outsider have it. Never let a man see it. I would never take him there. But if I sell him some of my leaves, Sanpa and I will be able to...
Sanpa? She nearly shouts. He's never coming back! And even if he does, do you think we would allow you to leave with him? Where would you go, hmm? What would you do?
I have answers to her stinging questions. He is coming back. They can't stop me from leaving with him when I've walked to Meng Hai and back alone. We would go wherever he wants. We would start a life in his family's newlywed hut, or go to a whole new village, as he once suggested. But why bother trying to turn a monkey into a goat? Ama will not change her mind about Mr. Huang or Sanpa. Stay away from that tea man, and forget about Sanpa. But the temptation and my dreams are too great. I climb the mountain and fill a basket with unfurling leaves from the very tips of each branch of the mother tree. I tell myself these are not the best leaves. Those would have come in the first 10 days of tea-picking season. But Mr. Huang buys them, paying me even more than he did last year. Once again, we visit the faraway village so that I can process the tea in secret. One day later, Ama goes to the grove and discovers what I've done. I wish she would shout at me, but that's not the Aka way. Instead, she punishes me with quiet words. Was it worth it? Did it make that boy return for you? It's been more than a year. You sold your greatest gift. You sold your honor. In my shame and despair, I finally accept. He's never coming back. Anguish nearly destroys me. I'm like a leaf that's fallen from its home branch and now spirals down, 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 floating out over a cliff, buffeted by winds, shredded out of existence. Ama stops asking me to accompany her on healing visits. The sisters-in-law, following Ama's example, pretend I no longer exist. My brothers ignore my face swollen from so much crying. Abba doesn't even notice what's happening to me. I feel too guilty to go to my grove for solace and solitude. I can't talk to Sitte, because where would I start? And even if I could confide in her, she's never around. These days, she spends every free moment stealing love in the forest with La Ba, the boy Ama and Abba once wanted me to marry. She's turned into the type of girl she once accused me of being. The one who disregards the comforts of friendship to give her full attention to a boy. I end up spending my days and nights under the house with the dogs, pigs, chickens, and ducks. The smell is rancid and foul, and the animals stare at me with baleful eyes. If Aka Law is correct, and everything on earth is connected, then our animals are aware of my humiliation. I feel as low as a human reject. And yet life continues around me. Sitte's family announces she'll soon marry La Ba, and the whole village enjoys a celebratory feast. I must attend the festivities, but they are heartbreaking for me. Not so long ago, Ama and Abba intended this joyousness for me. Soon after the banquet, all three sisters-in-law come to a head in the same cycle. The news is greeted by great rejoicing in hopes of the arrival of new grandsons. Sacrifices are made to ensure good deliveries, and everyone in my family eats proper foods, because these simultaneous pregnancies are so auspicious. Joy and optimism spread through Springwell. Even in my hiding place, I can't avoid the sounds of pigs being bred, cats yowling that they found mates,
and boys and girls singing their attraction to each other from hilltop to hilltop. The flowers bloom at their peaks, waiting for the butterflies to come. The first line of the love song reaches me. How unfair. The next line belongs to the girl. It should be, the honeycombs wait for the bees to make honey, but I can't hear it. She must be singing away from my direction. A relief. A beautiful flower calls to her love. The male voice comes closer. I cover my ears. Ah, Luce, ahi, ahi-o, ahi, ahi-o. The song tortures me. I hum a planting tune to drown out the pitiless sounds of ardor. Later, I feel the thumps of footsteps climbing the men's veranda and remove my hands from my ears. The singing is over, at least. The bamboo floor above me squeaks and heaves as my father and brothers pace back and forth. Footsteps rattle down the stairs. Third brother's feet come into view.
Girl, you'd better come.
I go around to the women's veranda. Amma and the sisters-in-law are all standing when I enter the house. Amma wears one of her impenetrable expressions.
He's returned, first sister-in-law states.
I rush to the men's side of the house. Sanpa! He looks thinner, wiry, older. A man now. I run into his arms. He holds me tight. His heart beats into me. He speaks over my head to the men in my family.
I've recited the lineage for you. Your daughter and I have no matching ancestors for 7 generations. Your daughter does not have seizures, nor is she troubled by insanity. Neither do I have these afflictions. I went away to earn money so that I can take care of her when she's at university.
My daughter didn't take the Gaokao.
How is it that Abba can so easily use against me something that he once opposed? I notice, though, a long silence from Sanpa. Finally, Sanpa sputters,
I've come with the proper gifts for your family to seal the arrangement.
Abba clears his throat, but when Sanpa won't allow him a single objection, I know my future husband has forgiven me my failings as a student. But can we have a life together if I don't tell him about our baby?
Most important, your daughter is older than 13, he goes on, gaining momentum again. You and I both know that we could have married in the past without your permission, but I sought it anyway. I respected your wishes. Now you must respect mine. I have come to fetch a wife, and I expect your daughter to go work eat with me.
Look how Sanpa has changed. If only he'd spoken this forcefully sooner, we would have been sleeping and doing the intercourse in his family's newlywed hut until our daughter's birth. When Abba addresses the traditional phrase to me,
go get married to him then.
I understand that Sanpa and I have finally won. Without another word, Sanpa takes my hand, and together we run out of the house and into the forest. We don't stop until we reach our special clearing. Panting from excitement, from our running, we stare into each other's faces. He is dirty from his travels, and my hands shoot to my cheeks. I must look and smell dreadful. But he doesn't seem to mind. He grabs me, and we fall together on the bed of pine needles. We don't even take off all our clothes. He is even thinner than I thought when I first saw him. I can feel his sinews and bones under his skin. Once the intercourse, lovely and urgent, is over, we lie together. I've experienced numerous adversities in my 18 years, but telling him about Yenye is one of the hardest. He tightens his arms around me when I weep out the truth. I'm sorry this happened, he says when I'm done. I failed you,
But that doesn't mean I'll fail our daughter. We'll go to Meng Hai and get her. Why hadn't I thought of this? Because my despair had forbidden me even to hope for a chance to get Yan Ye. But is it still possible to change her from a human reject into a daughter? People will know she came before our wedding. If we could have lived in the city near your school, he says, his tone surprisingly sharp, we would have avoided that problem. This reproach stings more than it should when all I should be is happy to get Yan Ye. And we can't stay on Nanuo or any nearby mountain where people might hear about us. His brow furrows as he ponders the problem. After an uncomfortably long pause, he comes to a decision. We should go back to Thailand. I can get work there, and she will not yet be so big. In Thailand, they will think we were already married when you gave birth, just as they already think I was born on Sheep Day. So propitious for a sheep and a pig to share a home, don't you think? He smiles reassuringly. And here? By the next time we come back, you will have borne me a son. My Ama and Abba won't bother counting her teeth to judge her age after they see him. He has taken charge of our lives as all husbands should. How I love him in that moment. Can we go get her right now? I ask. Sanpa laughs and pulls me back into his arms. Aka weddings are complicated and drawn out for days, sometimes weeks. Not ours. Everything happens over 3 nights because we're anxious to pick up our baby. I'm dressed in a white wedding skirt, a gaily decorated kerchief, and my usual tunic and leggings when two elders from Sanpa's village arrive in Spring Well to set the rituals in motion. They present Aba with coins. These are not a bride price in a traditional sense. Rather, they are, as the older man says, to pay for the mother's milk your daughter drank. Then come the yips and yelps of a group of young men who shepherd Sanpa into the village. Aba announces that our family is going to host a fill-the-carry basket ceremony so I might gather a proper dowry, which tells me he has accepted the circumstances. Sitae sits with me when the Ruma recites a special poem about me, listing my attributes from the time of my birth to today. She only got in trouble one time. She is a good worker. And so on. The Ruma then asks Sanpa, do you need to test the machete before you buy it? This sends Sitae into a spiral of laughter because he's asking if Sanpa and I have yet stolen love. If not, we'd be required to go to the forest right then. Still, I'm a bride, so I turn crimson when Sanpa answers, the machete has been tested and the rice already cooked. Aba presents me with a carrying basket to take to my new home. Ama gives me a rain cape and a new set of clothes, plus her silver bracelet with the two dragons facing each other nose to nose. It's beyond what I could have hoped for, considering her feelings about Sanpa. My brothers contribute packets of rice seed that Sanpa and I will be able to plant when we reach our new home. First sister-in-law and second sister-in-law each cut a bangle from their headdresses as tokens for me to remember them by. Third sister-in-law presents a blanket decorated with her fine embroidery and appliqué. I pack these things in my carrying basket, tucking the money Mr. Huang paid me at the bottom. I haven't yet told Sanpa about my savings. I want to surprise him if a time comes when we need it. And while most brides must relinquish their rights to the property they were allotted in the 30 years no change policy to their abbas or brothers, Ama promises to care for my grove. She also gives me some last-minute advice, and it's as traditional as can be. Next come the messages that Ama actually wants to give me, passed through intermediaries. She pushes first sister-in-law forward,
Remember that if you want to terminate your marriage, you can always run away, but you can't come home. From second sister-in-law, remember that if you have children, you will need to leave them behind when you run away. Third sister-in-law's message must not be a good one, because she looks embarrassed. She whispers in my ear, if a gopher does not have his escape route dug and ready ahead of time, then it will be difficult to run away when he needs it. These are the last things Amma wants to tell me as I leave home? Does she really think that after all Sanpa and I have been through, I would ever follow the Akka rituals that would give me a divorce? Never! Neither will I give him cause to divorce me by being lazy, arguing with his parents, stealing love with another man, or not giving him more children in addition to our Yunye, who is days away from my arms. Then it's time for goodbyes. Abba and my brothers blink back emotions. The sisters-in-law openly weep, and Amma dabs at her cheeks with the hem of her tunic. I see the headman, the Nima, the Ruma, Site and her family, and so many others. Even Teacher Zong has come to wish me farewell. The voices of the women in my natal family rise up in song. When living under your father-in-law's roof, you must obey his rules. When living next to your mother-in-law, you must follow her instructions. When living near a brother-in-law, avoid him as a pestilence. When living with your son, know his life comes first. Sanpa and I reach the spirit gate. I should be crying loudly to show the pain of leaving my family and my village, but I don't cry. I don't even look back. When we arrive at Shelter Shadow Village, Sanpa's mother greets me with a boiled egg, signaling her acceptance of me. Mothers-in-law are difficult the world over, and I've seen how severe Amma can be with my sisters-in-law. But so far, my future mother-in-law seems determined to put aside her past disapproval. A few hours later, Site comes to perform the next part of the ritual. She's brought with her the heavily decorated headdress that first announced my maidenhood and will now mark me as a married woman. Remember that a wife must never overstep her husband's knowledge, she recites. I'm glad she's here, and I try to absorb her words, which she herself will receive upon her marriage to La Ba, so that I'll become a perfect wife. As soon as I have that thought, a realization comes to me. I'm sorry, Site, that I won't be able to deliver your headdress when the time comes. That is a pain beyond imagining, she admits. Please know that into every life my soul is born, I'll always be indebted to your soul, whatever form it takes, for all the ups and downs we've shared. She nods tearfully before resuming her marriage duties. Remember never to overtake your husband on the path, she says. Remember never to crow like a rooster. Remember always that you are only a hen. Sanpa's Amma takes the headdress from Site and places it in the newlywed hut. Site gives an almost imperceptible nod. Good luck. I hope you'll be happy. We'll be friends forever. I smile at her and try to memorize every detail of her face, not knowing how long it will be before I see her again. As she turns to begin her journey home, Sanpa and I enter the newlywed hut. The village Ruma waits for us. He gives us our meal of joining, a single cooked egg, a single glass of rice wine, and a single cup of tea, to share. Once I put on my headdress, our wedding ceremony is complete. I am now wife of Sanpa and daughter-in-law to his parents. I'm happy, but a part of me, that hard stone I carry within me at all times, reminds me of our daughter. Why couldn't things have happened differently? Why couldn't Sanpa have come sooner? But then another thought.
Only 2 more days and I'll have her next to my heart again.
Sun-pa and I go back outside. A group of men herd a pig to our door.
Sun-pa stabs his knife into its throat.
The men restrain the animal so its blood can spurt into a bowl.
Once the pig dies, Sun-pa slits it open and removes the liver.
This is taken away for the Ruma, Nima, and village elders to examine for good and bad omens.
Each minute that passes is another minute of joy.
Our marriage feast begins with a soup, followed by fried potato wedges, bitter melon with scrambled egg, sautéed eggplant and garlic, pickled mustard greens, and special meatballs made from minced meat from the slaughtered pig mixed with its blood.
The people of Shelter Shadow complete their welcome of me by singing a wedding song filled with good wishes.
You are the new bark on the tree of our village. May your life together become strong as wood. Rings growing one link at a time, a part of the Aka line.
That night, Sun-pa sleeps in his parents' house, and I retire to the home of one of his uncles.
To say this is difficult?
Wah.
Tradition.
The next day, a woman elder escorts me into Sanpa's family house to bathe me. I feel embarrassed for her to see me naked. Will she be able to tell I once had a child? Meanwhile, villagers hit the eaves with long sticks.
Move in, soul! Move in! Move in!
I wish I could tell them that they don't have to work so hard at this, because my soul moved in with Sanpa's a long time ago.
Once I'm dressed, I return to the main room.
3 elders take turns circling an egg around us.
It sounds easy, but it's hard for 1 elder to pass the egg to the next elder without dropping it.
I hold my breath, so nervous. I look over at Sanpa for encouragement, but he's even more anxious than I am.
If one of the elders drops the egg and it cracks, then we would not be able to have any more children, have a happy life, or live to become elders ourselves.
At the end of the evening, I'm invited to sleep on the woman's side of Sanpa's family home, while he sleeps on the men's side.
How tantalizing it would be to slip out, run into the forest, and do the intercourse.
But if we did that, our newlywed blessings would decrease.
We've already had such ill luck that I don't want to attract bad spirits intent on troublemaking.
On the 3rd morning, Sun-pa and I go door to door to beg for blessings. We carry bowls of chopped pig meat and liver, as well as a bottle of liquor to share. In exchange, people give me gifts of money and silver trinkets.
Again and again we hear, "May you have a long life. May your animals multiply. May your tea pickings and rice crops be plentiful. May you have many children."
Finally, finally, at the end of a night of feasting and dancing, Sun-pa takes me to our newlywed hut. I feel nervous, yet eager, shy, yet bold as I start to undress.
The next morning, Shelter Shadow's Ruma kills a chicken and inspects it for bad signs.
The tongue is in the normal position, which is fortuitous. If it had been twisted, it would mean that Sun-pa and I would argue on our journey.
I can't imagine ever arguing with my husband.
"Has a tiger ever killed an animal in or around our village on this day of the cycle?"
Sun-pa asks.
The Ruma and Nima consult and agree that no such thing has occurred. With no more rituals left to complete, Sun-pa and I lift our baskets to our backs and depart.
Sun-pa has told me that it's 250 kilometers from Nanuo Mountain to the village outside Chiang Rai in Thailand where we're going.
First, though, we head in the opposite direction, to Mang Hai.
After a half-day's journey, we join the path I took when I carried Yan Ye off the mountain. When night falls, we sleep among the rubber trees.
In the morning, Sun Pa uses his machete to scratch the dirt where we rested.
Wake up! Wake up! Let's go!
He smiles at me and explains, all hunters do this to make sure we don't leave our souls behind. I am not a hunter, so I didn't know this ritual when I came this way with our baby. What if Yanye's soul got lost? What if mine ran away? What about all the ways, both small and large, that Sun Pa and I have skirted fate? By the time we reach Menghai's Social Welfare Institute, I'm both hopeful and frightened. As we enter, the smell of urine hits my nose with a powerful slap. On the floor in front of us, a scramble of babies and toddlers. There are so many of them. Even as Sun Pa talks to the woman in charge, I dart from child to child. They're all girls. This one, too old. That one, too young. Eyes too squinty. Ears too pronounced. Too much hair. Not enough hair. All this as though I would recognize Yanye after leaving her months ago in a cardboard box down the street. But I tell myself, a mother would know.
Wife!
When I turn, I expect to see Sun Pa with our baby in his arms. Instead, he anxiously shifts his weight from foot to foot. Next to him, a woman has puffed her cheeks in anger.
Did you leave a baby here?
She demands shrilly.
Do you know that is against the law? I'm going to call public security. Wife,
Sun Pa calls again.
We must go. Hurry, now.
But I can't move, because a couple of the toddlers have latched onto my legs. But even if I could move, would I? I came here for Yinye. Sun Pa crosses the floor and grabs my hand. The babies and small children startle at his abrupt action. Two begin to wail, then another two, and more after that. Caretakers in pink smocks come running from other rooms. In a different situation, Sun Pa and I would look comical the way we tiptoe in and around and over the babies. The woman in charge crosses her arms indignantly as we approach.
We have a child here, I confess, my voice coming out as breathless as if I'd raced Site up a mountain. We've come to get her.
Only the truth will help me, and maybe this woman will have a kind heart. We're just married. We're beginning our lives together at last, but we need our daughter with us. If we take her, you'll have one less mouth to feed. And I pull one of my new silver wedding bracelets off my arm and offer it to her. We can pay. Babies howl. The caretakers scoop up the loudest screamers. Sun Pa glances apprehensively from the woman's face to the door, ready to bolt. I hold the woman's gaze. I want my baby, please.
My name is Director Joe, and I prefer that bracelet, she says, pointing to the one Amma gave me just days ago. It's my most valuable possession, but I readily give it to her.
So tell me, she asks, slipping the bracelet onto her wrist. What day did your baby come to us? Does she have any scars or a birthmark? She was wrapped with a tea cake. Director Joe instantly brightens. I remember that one. But as memories of Yanye return, her face falls. We sent her in a caravan with other infants to Kunming 2 months ago. I reach for Sun Pa. We can go there. Before Sun Pa can respond, the director continues. She's been adopted. She's no longer in China. She has new parents. In America. The world around me goes black, and I feel myself falling to the floor. I follow Sun Pa on mountain path after mountain path, up, down, up, down. My mind is deadened from heartbreak. Sun Pa keeps his thoughts to himself. He's barely spoken to me since I fainted in the Social Welfare Institute. A few times a day, he wordlessly flicks his fingers at me. Stay. Before disappearing off the path and leaving me alone with my anguish. I am a wife now,
and I must grow accustomed to his male ways, but I worry he won't come back, and I'll be lost out here, alone, forever. While I wait, I mark a tree or build a stack of rocks, just in case. But he always returns, jittery and anxious or sleepy and lethargic. I've only been married a few days, so what do I know? Maybe Abba was like this to Amma when they first wed. We reached Daluo, on the border between Yunnan and Myanmar. Sunpa asks some men if there's been any recent movement along the border, because we don't have papers, but nothing has changed since he last passed this way. After we make our camp back in the jungle, he sits down across from me.
Wife, we must forget the human reject. We'll have more children.
He's trying to be kind and soothe my pain, but how can I forget Yenye? I lost her once and suffered. I had hope, and then I lost her again. She's so far away now, it's as if she's dead. That knowledge, sharp as a knife, twists in my heart, doubling, tripling the pain I had when I abandoned her.
When Sunpa says, "We should start right now, trying to make another baby,"
I turn away from him and weep into the crook of my arm. When I recite, "No wife should deny her husband in the first cycle of married life," he wordlessly accepts the depth of my guilt. The next morning,
"Wake up! Wake up! Let's go!"
We traverse thick jungle, reeking with rot, heavy with humidity, and empty of people. At some point, we pass an unmarked border and travel on to our first Myanmar village, where Sunpa leaves me to buy supplies. I'm standing in the path that divides the village, staring at nothing, my mind with my baby and her new parents in America, when a woman's voice speaks my name.
Li Yan?
My eyes try to focus. I see a woman in filthy rags. Her face is thin and worn.
It's Deja. And it's been 8 years since she and Sido were forced out of Spring Well for having human rejects.
Are you real? I ask. Is it you?
I shouldn't have spoken. She lowers her eyes, humiliated for me to see her in such abysmal circumstances. Forget you saw me.
Forget? My body surges with sudden urgency. Destiny, my Amma would call it coincidence, has brought us together, for only you can understand what I'm feeling now. I glance down the path that separates this hideously poor village. Where is Sido? Instead of answering, she takes hold of my arm more forcefully than is necessary, and pulls me with her to the right, past a few molting chickens and a single house, and into the jungle, where ruthless greenery instantly swallows us. Above us, a thick canopy of branches blocks the sky. Mosquitoes whine, and tropical birds screech. We reach a lean-to made of bamboo and thatch. A fire pit is dug in the ground before it. Trash has been tossed here and there. A few pieces of clothing hang from low branches. The person who lives here has no respect for nature or herself, and that person is Deja. Together we squat on our haunches. How long will it be before Sunpa wonders where I've gone?
Did Sido go back to Spring Well?
Her eyes gleam with an unsettling combination of desperation and loyalty. When I tell her we have not seen him, she remains silent for a long while.
I hoped he'd gone home, she says at last.
What happened?
Where do I start? She asks. When my monkeys were born.
I wince at the euphemism for her human rejects.
No one would look at us. You know that Sido wasn't allowed to wear his turban, nor I my headdress. He didn't carry a crossbow, and I had milk leaking from my breasts. It wasn't hard for people to guess we'd been banished for having human rejects. We kept walking until we reached Thailand.
Sunpa says life is good there.
You're here with him? she asks, surprised. Of course, she'd remember the incident of the stolen pancake.
But how?
Finish your story, and I'll tell you mine. She sighs.